read my bio, didn't he? Well done. So welcome, everyone. This is, how many times we've done this? Like seventh time. So really grateful. If this is your first time, welcome. If this is your seventh, let me buy you a beer. So really happy that you're spending some time with me. I realize time is our only commodity. So I'm really grateful that you're here, and I'm hoping to provide some value for you. So there's a lot of hype right now, and I'm not wanting to sell you a dream. Actually, this talk is going to be a couple of like horror stories. And I think that's been a bit of a theme these last couple of days. And that's been like the due diligence, making sure that you know what you're doing and before you leap. Oh, yes. So it's just really important that you don't believe the hype. The influencers are great. They're really good. Really good at selling you like time, your eyeballs on YouTube. But let's have some real talk here. So who am I? And why should you listen to me? So I've been in Japan 26 years. I came as a software engineer, which has nothing to do with real estate. I'm the vice president of my family business, N4. We make language learning software, software applications, dictionaries, phrase books. But in a former life, I actually used to be a chemist. I used to blow myself up a lot. So I was just not destined for the laboratory. So I retrained in IT and came to Japan 26 years ago. So I've lived a couple of different lives. I've been a chemist, a biochemist, and but also I used to run a bar in Goldengai with my husband here. And I've been an author, and I've lived a couple of lives here. But I am old, so. Tokyo Family Stays started as a kind of side hustle. My life really has been a series of side quests. It started in 2011 when my son, who's now 15, was a baby. We had too many people coming to stay, wanting to come stay with us in our small Tokyo apartment. Not possible. So I took the leap and went, okay, well, let me rent a second apartment just down the road, and then we use it for family and friends. When it's not being used, we'll put it out for rental. My goal was to break even. That was 30 houses ago. So it took off like a rocket. I really discovered that I enjoyed the hospitality side. I love showing people my town. I love showing people behind the curtain of what it's actually like to live as a migrant, which I am. I call myself a migrant in Japan. And so I have a really unique point of view that is interesting for people, and people want to pay for that. So I've leaned into that. But around 2018, or between 2016 and 2018 is where life really changed for short-term rentals in Japan. It was the wild, wild west before that. And then we thought, well, okay, let's get serious. So that meant getting licensing, getting the kanri license, getting the properties we wanted to be licensed, letting go of the ones that were not going to work. And with the Olympics looming, don't get me started. With the Olympics looming, it was like, okay, five-year plan, let's do it, let's lean in, and let's get serious and professional about it. And the business grew. Seven-figure business, and actually, Sarah Furrier is sitting here. I remember talking to you when we hit our first $100,000 month, and that was just like, wow, we built this from nothing, and I remember celebrating with Sarah, who's sitting right here. Hosted countless guests in the last 14 years. But the other thing that I've been very, very serious about and very intentional about is building very strong community ties. And that's been, I think, the difference to create a business that is profitable and sustainable, and one that I'm actually really proud of. I'm really proud of the business that we've built. But let me get into some of the things that I've learned, and hopefully this will be of value to you and if you're looking at creating a business for yourself. But real talk, a lot of influencers are out there saying, oh, it's easy, it's this, it's that. But the reality is somewhat different. People see Japan as safe, reliable, as a rule of law. Absolutely. It makes it easy to do business here. In terms of understanding the predictability. Doesn't make it simple. It makes it predictable, But you do have to lean into the regulations and also the compliance, which is very strict. And the other thing is, Minpaku is not passive. It's not a business that you can just think, oh, I'll put it up on Airbnb and I'll, you know, make a bit of extra money. I hear that a lot, but I'm just wanting to, you know, adjust that that mindset moving forward. It's an active compliance business, and it's a community business, and it's not passive. So Minpaku rewards structure. So if you approach things in a structural way, you will be rewarded. If you assume that things will work as they do elsewhere, leave those assumptions at the water's edge. It's a different animal here, and you'll be punished if you. Honestly, your capital will be punished if you assume that. I'll just roll back a little bit. What I'm going to talk about here is Minpaku, but I'm using that term to encompass anything that's a furnished rental. So not a long-term rental, which is unfurnished. That's a different beast altogether. Anything that's furnished, I'm talking monthly, you know, monthly corporate rentals, service departments, hotels. I'm using that Minpaku term to encompass all of those things. They're slightly different paths and they're different regulations, but I'm here really just to talk about the approach rather than the nitty gritty of each individual deal, because as you'll hear, it's all local and it's all case by case. So the short answer is that the address will really constrain your pathway and where you're going to go with the business plan. So, but the principles, like I said, the mindset will encompass all of these different options, but then you'll just have to lean into each individual property and address. So we've got Minpaku, monthly rentals, and ryokans and hotels. I'm not here to talk about long-term chintai. There's other people who can talk about that. So you don't choose the strategy first. It's the asset and the location that chooses this for you. So it's more than a property investment here. What you're leaning into here is this nice little Venn diagram here, which is a combination of the regulatory, the compliance, and community. This may surprise you, but I'll get into that later. But the regulatory is what you expect, the laws that are in place in Japan, how you navigate them, compliance, building codes, safety codes, and how to work with OTAs. And community, it's a community business. Often it's your neighbours that will dictate your operational longevity. So how sustainable your business will be after you've been managed to get the licence. So having all of this in place will give you a solid foundation. So I'll just talk about the illusion a little bit. Don't worry, I won't do magic, I promise. So the illusion is like, oh, it's legal, everything's fine. But people forget. Often it's 180 days, so your pro forma will have to, you know, will have to take into consideration when you're looking at your business plan, and also each ward, each address, zone by zone, it's very, very different. People think, oh, I'll just get the house and I'll put it on Airbnb later. Uh-uh. You probably can, but doing this due diligence first will. Ensure that you don't hit the roadblocks later. There's fire compliance, and also the zoning. And then people say, oh, everyone is doing it. It's really easy. However, I don't know if people have seen news lately. There's been a few horror stories of hosts doing it badly and giving people like me a bad name, which I kind of get annoyed about. But there is a lot of pushback. So it's up to the good hosts to really break down some of the myths and start helping to educate the community about how to do it well and what the benefit to Japan and also to their community is potentially possible if they're supporting you and your business be a profitable business. The other thing is, not all real estate is hospitality suitable. So, and this is a bit of a mindset shift. So when you buy something for Minpaku, it's more than the bricks and mortar. it's you're buying a regulatory pathway, and if that pathway is blocked, the business is useless, or you've got dead capital, or you have to pivot, or you have to change strategy. I always say that real estate is kind of my place of business and not my actual business. So I'm here at a real estate conference, but I'm a bit of an interloper because hospitality I see as my business. So again, hard truth, you're not buying a building, you're buying a pathway when you approach to a Minpaku strategy. These are the people you need to listen to. These are your stakeholders, and these are the people who will be your allies. Listen to them. So let's look at how the deals actually fall apart. I've seen different deals fall apart at different ways, and I've had to come in partway through and solve some problems that people have jumped in too quickly, and I've been able to solve some problems later on. But here are the key players, and if you listen to all of these people, then, and also have the communication between all of these players, that's the key to having a successful, a viable project. So the ward office, they're the ones who set the rules. That's your first port of call. It's hyperlocal. There is, you know, people say, well, where's the easiest place to run a Minpaku? Well, even street to street, it's different. And asking, you know, anybody to say, oh, what's the best thing? Or people ask me, what's the best place? I can't tell you. The first call I always make, or one of my team makes, is directly to the ward office. So they're the gatekeepers. The Shihor Shoshi, my Shihor Shoshi is one of my favourite people in the world. My life is way too short to deal with Japanese paperwork and bureaucracy, and so it's the best money I ever spend. I listen to what she says, and I do exactly what she says. There is no wiggle room. I don't try and charm my way through. It's like I find out what the rules are and I just do it. The fire consultants, these are slightly different from the Shihor Shoshi. So the fire consultant, they're the people who liaise directly with the fire department. And sometimes the fire department and the ward office have slightly different building code rules. Now, you cannot move forward on anything until you have the fire department online. So all of these things are, they happen kind of at the same time. I've had a deal where I've passed through the ward office I've passed through the fire department, and then the ward office has a slightly different regulation. So I've had to go back to my electrician and have different fire alarms put in, and that actually just happened fairly recently. So that held up the project. And then the architects and or the renovation people, you have to tell them what all of these other players are saying so that they can do the work from the start perfectly, and you don't have to go back and do any retrofitting. Can't negotiate, or you can't, there's no wiggle room on any of these steps. There is no, there's no shortcuts, unfortunately. So, this is a failure. I'm getting bad news today, aren't I? I'll get to money later. I'll get to the profits later. So, speed over sequence. Again, what I see people do is they try and jump some of these processes. If you try to skip speaking to the Shihor Shoshi, or you think you're going to save yourself a couple of bucks by not speaking to that person, it will cost you time. And time when you're looking at getting to market is money. And so if you haven't spoken to the Shihor Shoshi or you haven't spoken to the fire department, you will hit hidden compliance blocks. Normally, you buy the property, you consult the experts, and then you attempt to fix the issue. That's, again, something what you do abroad, not what you really need to do here. Don't fall in love with a property before you've spoken to everybody. You have to do your, you know, you don't have to worry so much about missing out on something because there is so much availability out there. So take the time to consult all these experts along the way before you buy. Now, Seth is up here, and he's someone who goes out and does all that due diligence for AkiHub and do that work. Absolutely do that work. You can't reverse engineer the compliance side. And so really, this is where most people fall over. This is where most investors either, I don't want to say disaster, because disaster sort of seems like it's going to be, you know, like you're putting your money all up in flames. It's what will happen is it'll slow everything down, or you might cost you a bit more money. Manage the expectations. Think, oh, I'll figure it all out later. But then the reality is the ward office will block it. When a ward office, city office, Hawkengel, and then you're stuck with some dead capital, or you have to invest more than what you thought, and so your ROI will be decreased. So listening to the ward office from the get-go is, I feel like I'm harping on, like, you know, harping on this a lot, but I keep seeing it. People think, oh, I'll just get over it, I'll just do it. Time and time again, this is where people fall over. Fire trap. This is also where I've seen a lot of deals come to die. This is the silent killer. You've got a beautiful old machia, then the fire department says that you need to have a secondary escape route, or you have to change the floor plan. That gets expensive, really, really expensive. And I've seen a deal where missing escape routes has turned something that was potentially super profitable into something that's a really non-starter in terms of mimpaku, right? You'd have to convert, pivot to either a monthly rental or convert to a like a long-term rental. Or I've seen where the road on the outside of the house is too narrow. So it's not just the property itself, it's the access for the emergency vehicles. Rule of thumb, 4 meters for a hotel, 2.5 meters for mimpaku. You just have to, again, it's all case-by-case basis. Operational bleed. So this is something else that I see a little bit. Some people will think, oh, I've got the license, woohoo, pop the champagne, that's it, we're off to the races. But I see people ignore the asset. And then the reality is that staffing issues, platform disputes, guest damage. The license is not just the ticket to enter the arena. It is if you're looking to maximize your investment, you really, really want to make sure that you're on top of it on a daily basis. This is not a passive business. It's not for the faint-hearted. It takes a good manager. It takes a good manager with a lot of sweat equity and to keep that profit coming through at a maximum level. So the squeeze is worth the juice, but you've got to squeeze it. And then here comes some realities. Things are changing. It's not what it was, you know, 2018. Things change all the time. Zoning gets redrawn every year and it gets released in April. Compliance is tightening. If you see the toku mimpaku rules in Osaka, they're looking at reducing those from a toku mimpaku to a regular mimpaku. Toshimaku is really tightening up. Shibuya-ku has been upped. There's been at at the ward office level, when things get put up to a vote, there's been bills brought towards the Shibuya-ku, for example, to reduce compliance on the Shibuya-ku area. It gets knocked down on the vote every time, but it's on the radar. So things do change on a regular basis. And then when the rules change, you just have to follow it. So the other thing is that the local authorities are actively shutting down illegal operators. If you think that you can be a grey operator, or if you've got a weekend license and you're trying to rent during the week, you're going to get caught. At the moment, it's all very analog. However, it's coming that the platforms, the booking platforms, are going to be communicating with the ward office. And if you are not reporting, it's self-reporting right now. And if you are not reporting accurately, the government is catching up, and you will have to start answering some awkward questions.
They sent a couple of Brits to jail a few years ago, after the revamped the law, right?
Yeah. And also, if a property manager, if a Kandi has been shown to try to assist people breaking the law, the fines are ridiculous. So it's not worth it. Know what the rules are, play by the rules, yes, you'll have a sustainable business. There's no Japan rule only. Everything is local. So that makes it hard. It makes it hard that what works in Shibuya might be illegal in Shinjuku. So it really does depend on a case-by-case basis. So it's hyper-local. That's why you have the shihoshoshi to, because if you're busy running your business, you can't be looking at the compliance. I have someone who's looking at compliance all the time, just to make sure that I'm within the laws and making sure that I am doing the right thing. There's no universal rule. There's no Japan all rule. It's tightening, and illegal operators are actively being shut down. And so they should, right? Like, you know, looking after people where they sleep is a big responsibility and it's a big privilege. It's a duty of care involved. So again, I take that really seriously in my business because, you know, all my guests, they're paying, you know, they're putting food on my table. So, you know, I care about them. And illegal operators, you know, really, you know, really annoy me. Each ward does have the ability to interpret the laws as they see fit, depending on what their constituents are saying. And it is a social contract between the community, the chonai, and yourself. It's not just the piece of paper. So believe it or not, your first stakeholders are not actually your guests. They're the chonai. So they're your local community leaders. When I first started in Yoyogi, we went round and had a cup of tea with the guy who runs the chonai. He's like a million years old. He has three teeth in his mouth. But we went there with cookies and a bow, and it just smooths out. It smooths the way. Having that relationship with your community leader means they talk. He then knows every other small business in the area. And whenever there's any pushback, he'll go, they're good people, they're fine. And so having those allies within your community will, you know, making that effort, front-loading that even before you open, will set you up for success. They do hold the veto as well. So, and I think I was talking to one of my other clients just yesterday, they got the license and there's the, you know, they had some local pushback, they're flipped. And made a profit, which is good though. But if you do play smart, you can use those. You can use the chonai. You can use all the local businesses as an asset. Every time there's a festival, we buy the lantern. It's 5,000 yen, but that's an investment in the goodwill of the community. And I just think it's a really, I mean, I'm a bit nerdy about this, but you know, as a migrant, I just think I'm more community engaged maybe than my neighbours, but it does, you know, I'm really grateful that I have this, you know, profitable business that sustains me and my family, and I just want to show that back to the community. So how do you make friends with your neighbours? Have this as part of your strategy. So we have a mission statement, who we are, who we serve, what our values are. That's all translated. It's a bilingual document. So before we even open the doors, I'm knocking on all the doors of the neighbours. I'm giving them the piece of paper. I'm giving them clarity on who we are, how to contact us if they've got any concerns whatsoever. A couple of cookies. And that, people remember that. Most people, what are they going to be worried about? They're going to be worried that they're going to have all these yahoos with suitcases all day, all hours of the day or night. They're worried that people not going to be understand the trash rules, and they're just going to be worried about mewake. They're worried about being annoyed. So having that first line of communication means that you've allayed their fears. Their cortisol goes down. They're like, oh, okay, I've got someone to talk to if I'm concerned. That goes a long way for, you know, making an ally with your neighbours. having a mission statement that is communicable, that they then understand, that they know that you're serious and then you're not just going to let, you know, a whole bunch of yahoos, you know, run amok in the neighbourhood. And being able to have someone that they can call, if they're going to call you, they're not going to call the police, which is what they'll do. Okay. Oh, I'm really talking too much, aren't I? So I've got to keep going here. So this is a deal that looks perfect on paper. It had already been a minpaku. It was a three-story house. It's licensed, wooden, fully furnished, and it was in Shinanamachi. It was great, but it was strong yield on paper. Everything looked wonderful, but I always went and checked with the neighbours. I knocked on the door of the neighbour, and I was hounded out with a pitchfork, basically. He had cameras there. The people who had done it in the past had done it badly. And so the well was poisoned. There was absolutely no way I was going to take that deal on, even though the price and everything was right. Not going to touch that with a barge pole. Because the neighbour was so aggressive and so it would just make my life hell, would make the life of my guests hell as well. So a bit of a framework. Zoning, fire compliance, structural layout. So that's, you know, that's the being able to have all of your way to escape routes and also all of the fire alarms and fire extinguishers, which are to code. And then obviously your neighbours. And then you need the financial stress testing. So the deal isn't the price. The deal is the pathway. So if a cheap property with a blocked compliance is a bad deal, but getting something that's more expensive with a clear pathway is a good deal. I think I've really, really laid this on thick. So, but here's another case study that had a fire compliance breakdown. I'll go back. The customer had heard what the Shihoshoshi and the ward officer said in advance, had not communicated that with the person who was doing the renovation. So they just thought, I'll just do what I want to do, and then I'll get the certificates later. They were supposed to put a kitchen in the basement and they were supposed to have a fire door on the third floor. They didn't do that. Then, of course, when they went to get their license, it was like, boo-boo, denied. So that has then caused them to have to pivot to a monthly, a monthly rental scenario, which means lower profits. You're still going to be making money, but not as much as your initial, figures proposed. So, again, I take this really seriously. Where people sleep is a privilege and also a big responsibility. I think I've gone on this enough. I want to talk about money. And you were wondering when I was going to start talking about money. But really, what gets measured gets managed. Business 101. So these are the metrics that you need to be watching at all times. Gross revenue is a vanity metric. Lovely. I love seeing all that money come through the door. It is a vanity metric. What is important is your net revenue, your ADR, your RevPAR. Also, what's going to bleed is cancellations and having being able to look after your guests while they're there, but also the review scores. If you've got bad reviews, that is like a real race to the bottom. And also, you need to have some money in reserve because you will need to keep your compliance up, which means ongoing. It's not just set and forget. Like I said, the license isn't the finish line. That's the starting point. Again, gross and net revenue, ADR. ADR means average daily rate. Occupancy, RevPAR. These are all hotel terms. I've discussed these in the past, so if you need any background on what revenue metrics, how to calculate them. Marketing metrics, how much does it cost you to acquire a guest? Now, this is important data. What is your lead time? What is your cancellation rate? All of these will affect your bottom line. Your review scores, how the neighbours are, maintenance issues. If you're not looking after your guests are not looking after your house, it will cost you a lot more to keep it up to scratch. And then you will also need to keep cash buffers for compliance, ongoing maintenance, ongoing fire. I use a dynamic pricing tool. Price Labs is one of our sponsors here. You've probably seen the swag out in the hallway. I love them. Cannot work without them. Do not think that you can manage your revenue on your own. The dynamic pricing is some of the best money I ever spend. It means that I'm not missing out on cherry blossoms. I'm not missing out on any of those issues, like when Taylor Swift comes to town and the price goes up. So I don't have to do that manually. It's all done by Price Labs. I also use them to analyze the market. I'm not going to talk about market analyzing here, but that's also what I do. But grab that. That's a code for being able to get some market dashboards, how to estimate what your revenue is going to be. So I love, love, love them. But it also is important because you can watch the pacing. How is your property pacing against the bookings from the market? And you can adjust the strategy for if you're getting a lot of bookings 12 months in advance, those customers are not very price sensitive. So I've got a 30% price bump on people that are booking a year in advance. I'm capturing that inelasticity. And then using Price Labs to really adjust based on automatically what the market is doing. But you have to stay on top of it. It's not a set and forget type of thing. Also management. Cheap management will not maximize your profits. A manager that's going to be charging you 15% versus a manager that's going to be charging you 25%. If you're wanting to look at a manager who you can squeeze for the 15%, how many properties are they looking at? Are they dialed into who you are, into maximizing your profit? If it's the percentage that you're keen on, fine. If it's money that you get in your bank account every month, then come talk to me, because that's what I'm more interested in, rather than being the cheapest property manager on the block. Photography amenities, all of those things will give you a price bump. Just be careful at the moment, because Airbnb, for example, are going to be dinging people who using AI in their photography for their hero page. So that's something that's new that's come in that I'm sort of looking at the moment. You need to have enough money every year to get new photography done. Keep your place up to scratch. Otherwise, it really is a race to the bottom. Your reviews will go down as the wear and tear happens. So you do have to keep everything fresh. And with the property manager as well, make sure that they're aligned. They're aligned with who you are, who your property is, and who your customers are. So Chai last summit had some stats on the difference in profits between having a professional property manager and trying to do it alone. And you can go back to Chai's talk about that to show what the bump is from having a good dialed-in property manager versus, you know, either not doing it yourself or having a property manager that's got 400, 500 doors who really are just phoning it in. Okay, so when you delegate this thing, it's not an abdication. Like, I have a certain amount of skills. I would much prefer to delegate out to those people who have better skills than me in certain areas. So it's a regulated business. You cannot do it alone. The Shiho Shoshi, the fire people, and also all of the compliance in-house. I outsource all of this. So even with the best management company in the world, you still have to be reviewing data, and it's not a passive business. If you want a truly passive business, like maybe get a REIT. But if you're really going into Minpaku, there is a lot of profit to be made. But I just wanted to give you the real talk on how things are going. And also the algorithm, you've got to stay on top of it. Oh, I'm getting the wind up, sorry. But if you're not updating your photos annually, if you're not tracking your performance, if you're not going, if you're not adjusting your pricing strategy or doing anything seasonally, it's like the license. It's the license isn't the just the it isn't the finish point. It's the start point. So what is the cost of getting it wrong? You might have a 3 to 6 month licensing delay, or 2 to 5 million yen in unexpected compliance costs. You might lose out on a peak season, you might miss out on cherry blossoms this year, or you might have dead capital tied up in a non-viable asset. It's not all doom and gloom, because it's not usually a complete disaster. It doesn't look like a complete failure, it just means you'll have to pivot your strategy. And I've been able to do that in a couple of ways. People have got something that it was only available for weekends, but with a strategy of a hybrid strategy of monthly rentals and weekends, we've actually been able to maximize their profit completely. So it's never doom and gloom completely, but just be careful from the start. So the delay, if you don't do this due diligence at the start, you will be delayed, and that's where the profit margin dies. Okay, so sovereignty in Japan means respecting the system, and embrace the structure, respect the process, and build for the long term. It's not an afterthought. So here we go. But if you're wanting to discuss a pathway from Minpaku to Ryokan, I've done that, and I've actually done a talk on that a couple of summits ago, and also I'm happy to provide the case studies of those later. But yeah, here's a shameless plug. Come talk to me if you scan that, and that will get you onto my calendar. So there we go. Oh, I've got a breakout room coming in a bit, which will I'll break down some of the deals and help you, you know, with a personal. Break it down personally if you've got some one that you want to talk about specifically. Yeah, so that's me. So any questions there?
Oh yes, we have a few. The streamers have already been bombarding. Okay, so firstly, from the stream, if I own a condo in Tokyo and I use it for my own for my overseas second home, which I also let friends and family use for short term for free, meaning they're not charging, is this allowed like you did back in 2011? Mm-hmm. As there is no income, would it still be considered SDR? Nope. Will I be reported? Will I go to jail?
No. if you're not charging money for it, no. If you're charging money, then you would need to have people in for a month or more. And then they would need to have a fixed term lease. If you know, trying to get paid customers for one night, two night, three nights on Facebook, that's what's being shut down.
And I'll get hands in the room. And while I'm walking to the hands, I will ask a second question. What about workshop destination business? Does it need the same licenses as a Minpaku? Of course, with the Chonai. I'm not sure what a workshop destination business is.
Christian's there. If people are staying overnight, then that's what's considered the minpaku. If you're doing a day rental, so if you can list something as a workspace on Space Market or, you know, any of those space rental places, if as long as people are not staying the night, it's not the same thing. So that's not regulated.
What about somebody who does like a artist retreat where people, they don't pay for the lodging, but they also stay the night?
Oh, I don't know about that.
No,
I don't know. Well, I could think about it, but I can't think about it off the top of my head now.
Are you, as a consultant, are you helping people license their properties in other markets, or are you focused solely on Tokyo?
Licensing is above my pay grade. Like, my life is too short. I work with people and I give them the introductions to the people who can do the licensing, but on all of my contracts, on all of the things that I do, I say the licensing is you. I will help you maximize, I will help you figure out your ideal guest, I'll do your guest experience, I'll help you with your marketing, all of those things, that's all me. Because that's a hospitality business. Anything hospitality, I'm there. But because the licensing is so hyper-local, you need to have someone who's local to get you that license. Once you've got the license, come talk to me, and I will consult with you, and you can set up, maximize your profit. Even if I'm not doing the property management, I can still train you on how best
and
practices.
And for the properties that you have been involved in, or you manage, or your area of expertise, can you give us a rough idea of the cost or the expense to get the license?
A piece of string. How long is it? But usually, it depends on how much the retrofit costs, right? The actual paperwork is usually about between $150,000 to $300,000, usually what a Shihor Shoshi will charge. How much it will, but you will also need to get the retrofitting done. You may need fire retardant wallpaper. You will definitely need commercial grade fire alarms, fire extinguishers, fire lights, and that all needs to be connected to mains, and it has to be done by a licensed electrician. You can't just get any old, any old sparky, or if you know the end of which end of a hammer to use, you don't do that. You need to have the work done by a licensed electrician who then communicates that on your behalf to the fire department, and then the fire department gives you the certificate. You take that certificate with all the other documents that they give you and trot off to the ward office, and then they issue your license. So yeah, it is a step by step. It's a very, very clear process. Yeah.
I can take one more question from the room, but Tracy will be there for the breakout room after lunch as well. Do we have another hand in the room? If not, we've got one more question.
Paul.
Yes, okay.
Hi, thanks Tracy, that was really informative. I work as a real estate agent in Tokyo, so mm-hmm. I've got a client who's looking at a house, will you be able to consult with them to give them some kind of idea of how much, if it's a good spot or...
Oh, definitely, I absolutely do that. I use a Price Labs. I have a package where I create a Price Labs market dashboard based on the address, and that will suck in all of the data of the what's booking, how, like, the seasonality, the ADR, and also I do slice and dice based on what you're pitching it at. Is this a premium flight? Is this a budget? Is this a hostel? I can rather than just look at the aggregate of all the bookings, I will look at the stats so that they're relevant to that particular property. And yes, I do that.
Well, you had one more on social media there. Brandon, Toby, what was that?
So this was in relation to the 50-year terms, which are being introduced.
Oh, no, that's for a meal at the end of the day.
Yeah. The one you showed me.
Okay, so not related to Tracy. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so we will now be breaking for lunch. You have a one-hour lunch. Tracy will report to the breakout room.
I will report to the breakout room. But did Charles want to have a do you want to put your head around the corner and see if Charles wants to have 2 minutes? Charles
yep.
has sponsored lunch.
Yep.
So while we have a captive audience here,
yep.
Charles just wants to have 2 minutes of your time.
Yep.
To he can come in, actually.
Come in here?
Yeah, he can be on camera, actually.
Charles,
do you want to do your spiel? Can you just...
Sorry.
Charles is one of our sponsors.
Yes, Charles is from Tatemono IQ, who are very, very interesting, a property investment analysis tool. One of the tools we're showing here. Can I get you... Oh, you got the stream, so give him the stream mic. No, the other one.
Oh, okay.
Oh, maybe both of them, yeah.
Sorry, manhandling you.
Right. Yes,
this
Charles,
it?
Please.
This it? Oh, great. Caught me off guard. I was actually doing some coding out in the hallway. So Tatemono IQ is some... let me give you a brief story about the journey. So I started attending this conference about a year ago because I had plans to invest in property in Japan. So as I'm looking at deals, I'm trying to do the analysis, so I started building my own tools to facilitate that. And then one thing leads to another. I'm starting to use AI and large language models and generative AI to assist me with that. So then I kind of pivoted. Why don't I create tools for other investors to aid them in that type of analysis. So that's what led to Tata Mono IQ. Now, in its current form, it really targets both the Japanese real estate agent who wants to work with the foreign investor, as well as the foreign investor. So for the Japanese real estate agent, the benefit is they could work in Japanese, they could put in properties, they could put in private listings, and all of the information is automatically translated to English. And there are AI-assisted analysis that can be run that educates the foreign investor on the particulars of the Japanese market. So it's not really a listing site. It's fundamentally a tool. You put in properties, it does the analysis, it does the explanation, and everyone gains confidence in the decisions that they're making around their investments. So that's the fundamental premise. So we launched this weekend. Stop by, take a look. I can give you a demo. There's a lot of information on the site. It's tatamonoiq.com. In case you don't know, tatamono means building in Japanese. So this is building intelligence. tatamonoiq.com. And we're running a special introductory 3-month free trial. So I encourage everyone to take advantage of that.
Thank you very much,
and thank you very much, Tracy.